Welcome to New World Notes. I am Kenneth Doust. This week, the rest of the documentary on the Seven Sisters. It's about big oil, the Middle East, and the struggle to control and get rich from the world's oil. I hope you'll stay tuned. This week, we'll hear the second half of a short documentary called The Secret of the Seven Sisters, Desert Storms. It's a nice overview of 20th century history with a focus on Middle Eastern oil. To me, the documentary suggests three conclusions. First, the Anglo-American corporate oil cartel is a massive illegal price-fixing machine that for many decades simply stole the mineral wealth of the Middle East. And they got very rich and very powerful in the process. Second conclusion, the United States government, including its Army and CIA, protects the profits of these big private oil corporations, no matter what the human cost. That includes overthrowing governments, replacing democracies with dictatorships, and starting wars. Last week, we heard how, in 1951, the U.S. destroyed Iran's democratic government, led by Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh. We replaced him with a brutal dictator, the Shah. Along the same lines, this week we'll hear how the U.S. gave Saddam Hussein of Iraq our permission to invade Kuwait. Then we started Gulf War I because we were shocked, to find that Saddam Hussein had invaded Kuwait. I'll just mention that this was all perfectly obvious at the time, in 1991. We knew even then exactly what U.S. Ambassador April Glaspie had said to Saddam Hussein the day before Saddam invaded Kuwait. And that was, essentially, it's no business of ours. The third conclusion is that, ever since World War II, there's been constant conflict and war in the Middle East. And the more conflict there is in the Middle East, the higher the oil prices rise, and the richer the big oil companies get. The more war, the more death, the bigger the oil companies' profits. So, don't look for peace in the Middle East anytime soon. Well, those are my conclusions, and please feel free to draw your own. Let's pick up the story in 1960. Finally, the oil-producing countries got together and formed their own cartel, OPEC, to resist the plunder of the oil company cartel. Here is Sheikh Ahmed Zaki Yamani, who was Saudi Arabia's Minister of Petroleum from 1962 to 1986.
Well, the Western countries did not really feel that this little organization will be powerful. So they ignore it. The oil companies also, being very powerful, they ignored it. Not only this, they refuse to mention the word OPEC. And I know for sure that America was working very hard to convince some countries in the Gulf not to join this, including Saudi Arabia.
The creation of OPEC was greeted in the West with indifference, skepticism, and scorn. The Washington Post wrote, "OPEC, a belligerent conglomerate of camel-riding emirates." The West's overt contempt disgruntled the new leader in Iraq, Saddam Hussein. On June 1, 1972, without any notice, he nationalized the Iraq Petroleum Company. It put an end to the concession regimes which had handed over Iraq's oil to the majors for some 50 years.
Pierre Terzian, Director, PetroStrategies.
Lorsqu'en 1972, l'Irak a nationalisé
Iraq nationalized the oil consortium, the Iraq Petroleum Corporation, in 1972. Apart from a few Westerners, the company's directors were all Iraqis. The technicians were Iraqi, and so were the engineers and economists. So Iraq's nationalization of its oil was authentic.
The American majors were furious. Foreseeing this, Saddam Hussein called on the Soviet Union. Moscow supplied technical and military support. Then he turned to the French. France needed oil. Iraq, arms. The deal was a foregone conclusion. Arab oil nationalization and the creation of OPEC. This time, the Seven Sisters' power seemed to be severely undermined. Strangely enough, the Arab-Israeli conflict would serve the Seven Sisters' cause. In the midst of the Jewish Yom Kippur holiday, the Day of Atonement, in October 1973, Egypt and Syria attacked Israel. The surprise was total, and the Israeli defense lines were overcome. The fourth Arab-Israeli conflict had begun.
Xavier Uzel, oil trader.
Il est certain que le drame israélo-palestinien,
the Israeli-Palestine drama was an alibi. It is fortunate for the rest of the world, as consumers of Middle East's oil, that, as a result of the conflict, countries in the region remained divided. They deprived themselves of the means to improve their strategies and oil prices. That would have made them the richest countries in the world.
Armed and equipped by the United States, and empowered by their aerial supremacy, the Israelis' counteroffensive was victorious. As a reprisal to the Americans' support, Arab members of OPEC decided on a series of price rises. OPEC emerged from the shadows of scorn and indifference. After the nationalization of oil in Iraq, Iran, Libya, and Algeria, OPEC covered 70% of the world's oil. It announced a complete embargo against the United States and Holland, and it also embargoed shipments to Rotterdam, a major oil terminal.
We, according to our philosophy,
Sheikh Yamani,
we don't use oil as a penalty, a punishment, but as a political instrument to attract the attention that there is a problem between the Arabs and the Israelis. Some other oil producers within OPEC, they wanted to punish America.
In Washington in 1973, a wind of panic was blowing. Automobiles ground to a halt, and the world turned in slow motion.
President Richard Nixon.
In recent months, we have taken many actions to increase supplies and to reduce consumption. But even with our best efforts, we knew that a period of temporary shortages was inevitable. Unfortunately, our expectations for this winter have now been sharply altered by the recent conflict in the Middle East.
Strengthened by the capacity of their stocks and the staggering cost of a barrel, the Seven Sisters could boast colossal profits. Exxon doubled its revenues.
I was against increasing the price of oil, and they attacked me for that. But I knew for sure that very high prices will have a reaction. The reaction happened, but you don't come to oil producers who can make a lot of money and tell them, no, don't make a lot of money. They don't consider the strategy. Strategy, because when you raise the price of oil, you enable the oil companies to use the extra money to explore for oil. And this is what happened in the North Sea, in Mexico, and elsewhere. So the level of production outside OPEC took place, competing with the price of OPEC.
OPEC thought it had won the battle, but in fact, it had lost the war. The 1973 oil crisis was a gigantic manipulation. The Seven Sisters needed money, huge sums, to finally prepare for drilling the offshore zones in the North Sea. The Yom Kippur War, OPEC's embargo, and the rise in prices all benefited the Seven Sisters. The Arab countries were playing their enemy's game. In 1975, the Shah of Iran was the key player in the global oil game. Saudi Arabia was too weak, Iraq too threatening. And so with Nixon's blessing, the Shah became the Gulf's gendarme.
Professor Michael Clare.
And the Shah of Iran became an American puppet rather than a British puppet. In addition to the diplomatic and public face of U.S. support for the Shah, the U.S. also provided him with military assistance and assistance to his police forces and the secret police, SAVAK, the secret police of the Shah. And it was the secret police that was implicated in the repression and the slaughter of the Shiite clergy and other dissident groups inside Iran.
In exile in France, in Nofle-le-Château, the Shah's fiercest opponent, Ayatollah Khomeini, made a solemn appeal for resistance. A strike in the oil sector, he said, is an act of obedience to God. His message was heard. Not a single drop of oil was extracted. The people were in the streets, and the Shah's days were numbered.
2 mois après les grèves dans l'industrie pétrolière iranienne,
2 months after the strikes in the Iranian oil industry, the workers called for a complete shutdown of oil production. I remember the Americans saying a few days later, "We now know that with the Shah of Iran in place, there will be no oil production." It was clear to everyone that the Shah's fate was sealed. The oil that had overthrown Mossadegh was about to overthrow the Shah.
The Americans and their oil companies turned their backs on the emperor. Turmoil was not good for business. Sick and broken, the monarch left Iran. Only the Egyptian president Anwar Sadat deigned to receive him. Reza Shah would only be authorized to enter the United States 1 year later to die of cancer. Ayatollah Khomeini returned to Tehran in triumph. The West believed it could cope with the change in regime. Religious authority was better than communism. The USSR was far too close to Iran, but the Americans severely underestimated the new Shia government's anger and resentment. At congregational prayers on Friday, the same slogans can be heard as at the time of the Ayatollah more than 30 years ago. In 1979, for America, the oil companies and the Sunni Arab world, Iraq was the new ally. The secular regime in Baghdad was a shield against the Iranian Shia fundamentalists. In 1981, Saddam Hussein invaded Iran with everyone's blessing. The second oil crisis began, and the war was a sinister godsend for the Seven Sisters. The price of crude oil skyrocketed. For both the companies and the producing countries, petrodollars rained down in abundance.
So in the chaos of this moment of the Iranian Revolution in 1980, Saddam Hussein invaded Iran. And I believe his intention was to seize the southwestern part of the country where most of Iran's oil fields are located. He was somewhat successful at first, but then the Iranian Revolution mobilized young people, the Iranian Revolutionary Guards, and drove Saddam Hussein out of Iran and began to press into Iraq itself. And this caused a great deal of anxiety in the West, in Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, which began to fear the success of the Iranians, who were Shiites. And so they began supporting Saddam Hussein.
8 years of war took a heavy toll. More than 1 million casualties and extensive oil facilities destroyed on both sides.
Oil trader Xavier Uzel.
On a fait la guerre d'Iran.
We waged it because one country had to be used to destroy the other. The producing countries benefit from the oil bonanza. They build up financial reserves, and from time to time, they have to be bled.
The return of peace raised a question for the majors. Could peace lead to overproduction? The answer came from Kuwait. The emirate increased its own production by 20%. Oil prices fell immediately. In addition, the emir refused to cancel the $15 billion debt contracted by Iraq. Saddam felt betrayed by his former allies, who had all profited from the conflict.
Mohammed Ali Zaini, former Iraq representative to OPEC.
The major country which really kept overproducing and kind of assumed some intransigent mode was Kuwait. And that's what really pressured Saddam, because he really needed the money. Every time the price went $1 down, Iraq would lose $1 billion.
This was too much for Saddam Hussein, who informed the United States Ambassador April Glaspie of his intention to send military forces into Kuwait. She replied that this was an internal matter between two neighboring countries. The dictator was led to believe the US would not intervene. On August 2, 1990, Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait.
And so only a short period after meeting the American ambassador, Iraq invaded Kuwait. And if you ask me, was this a trap? I would say yes. Saddam fell into that trap 100%.
The net around Saddam was tightening. It was unthinkable for the American administration to allow the Iraqi dictator to confiscate Kuwait's oil. In 1991, in just a few days, the Iraqi forces were crushed.
As Commander-in-Chief, I can report to you, our armed forces fought with honor and valor. And as President, I can report to the nation, aggression is defeated, the war is over.
But the new world order sought by President Bush began in a raging inferno. It would take 9 months to extinguish the fires at some 750 wells sabotaged by the Iraqi troops.
Journalist Eric Laurent.
Kuwait
has always been seen as the Bush family's backyard. George Bush Sr., the president at the time, made his fortune through his oil company called Zapata by obtaining drilling rights in Kuwait's offshore oil fields after World War II.
At the beginning of the 20th century, this stretch of sand seized by Iraqi tribesmen lived under the protection of the British Empire. A small pearl fishing port that served the British Navy en route to India. In 1938, oil flowed from the Kuwaiti desert. The tiny emirate a mere patch of sand proved to be a veritable oil sponge. American and British companies exploited this desert treasure and made fortunes for themselves, for the emir, and his subjects.
Carmel Al-Harami, Kuwaiti oil analyst.
It was like an earthquake. It changed the whole face of Kuwait society. All of a sudden, we were in the press. All of a sudden, we were the biggest oil producer in the world. All of a sudden, we have the wealth. And from basically very basic living standard, you know, barely, you know, having food or barely having proper clothes, and all of a sudden, here we are. The doors of heaven open to us.
In January 2001, George W. Bush's Vice President Dick Cheney launched an energy policy development group, the Energy Task Force. The aims of this commission were surrounded in absolute secrecy. For the Washington Post, it was a secret society. More than ever, the American administration appeared to be an extension of the oil lobby. Dick Cheney, a former president of Halliburton, Condoleezza Rice, a former executive with Chevron, all committed to the oil company's cause.
In 2003, la commission est tout de même contrainte par un jugement d'une cour d'appel.
In 2003, a federal court required the Cheney Commission to release several documents. One document is very interesting. It's a map of Iraq, dividing the part that's close to Saudi Arabia into eight oil extraction zones. Oil was central to the strategy of this commission. Oil and Iraq.
The September 11th attacks to the heart of the American dream unleash unprecedented violence. Terrorism, weapons of mass destruction. The 9/11 tragedy is a long-awaited pretext. With the world's second-largest oil reserves, Iraq is designated as a response to America's energy requirements.
Iraq continues to flaunt its hostility toward America and to support terror. The Iraqi regime has plotted to develop anthrax and nerve gas and nuclear weapons for over a decade. States like these and their terrorist allies constitute an axis of evil, arming to threaten the peace of the world.
Baghdad.
This is a city in ruin. The calm waters of the Tigris form the horizon line from the Al Mansour Hotel.
Ships in the Gulf. A big explosion less than a mile from our hotel that followed this, the first hit on a government.
From these balconies, the world witnessed the American raids on the capital on television. When bombs hurled by invisible aircraft seemed to raise the city into the skies. On March 20th, 2003, the second Gulf War had just begun. In less than 3 weeks, the Abrams tanks leading Operation Iraqi Freedom reached the outskirts of Baghdad. The US troops' first mission was to secure the oil wells.
The first orders given to the military were to secure the oil installations. That was the priority. And to secure the oil ministry in Baghdad. Shortly after Saddam Hussein was overthrown, when the American troops entered Baghdad, the ministries were all pillaged. But when you saw the oil ministry, it was surrounded by armored vehicles, with a lot of Marines posted around it. This ministry was never touched, and not wrecked by demonstrators.
Ten years after the end of the war, the city still seems to be under siege. In Paradise Square, a new statue symbolizes the newfound freedom. It stands on the same base as the statue of Saddam Hussein that was pulled down on April 9, 2003. Was it the toppling of a dictator? or simply a war for oil.
That in the minds of Dick Cheney and George Bush and the others, this was a coincidence of interests, a convergence of interests, that a strategic advantage would be accomplished by eliminating Saddam Hussein and putting a pro-American regime in power in Iraq. And at the same time, that would make available the oil fields of Iraq for exploitation by American companies.
The Americans claimed to be introducing a new world order in the Middle East and winning the so-called war on terror. NGOs, for their part, report more than 120,000 civilian victims. Chaos ruled. The Sunnis, the Shias, the Kurds. The war in Iraq continued among sectarian militia. In reality, the American invasion, with its whiff of petrol, merely spread the stench of death.
One says that Iraq is the oil Eldorado. Well, this is indeed true. So it is really the last frontier, let us say. It is the last province that can be open one day to international oil companies, and they come and they find these supergiant fields, which are no more in the rest of the world.
Chinese, Russian, American, more than 150 companies jostle for position. And the stakes are high. Iraq's oil fields, the world's second biggest oil reserves. In 2009, contracts were signed, and the oil fields of West Kurna, Maju and Rumaila were attributed to ExxonMobil, Shell and BP. The Seven Sisters are very much present. Once again, they come out on top. Since the notorious hunting party at Aknakari Castle, they have never ceased to plot, to plan, and to scheme. Basically, to manipulate the course of world history.
And that's the way it is, I'm afraid. You've been listening to my radio adaptation of the documentary Secrets of the Seven Sisters, Desert Storms. The Seven Sisters is slang for the cartel of big oil companies, the gents who helped make the Middle East what it is today. Thanks, guys. The film appears to have been produced by Al Jazeera. I'm not a television viewer, but if you are, consider contacting your cable or satellite TV provider and asking them why the 250 channels you're paying so handsomely for include the soybean channel, the macrame channel, 14 home shopping channels, CBS, and 21 Christian religious channels, but not Al Jazeera English. Better still, why not pull the plug, save $1,000 a year, and give a little of that to your community-based, non-commercial, alternative radio station. On behalf of the entire New World Notes staff, this is Kenneth Doust, advising illegitimi non carborundum, put a tiger in your tank, happy motoring, and please come back again next week. Peace.